Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We tape on Tuesday for Wednesday because we Zoom, because we're doing it remote like the rest of the world. And as you've come to expect, every single day you will know everything that he's ever said at that impeachment hearing in 2019. But we begin with the words of Colonel Vindman. He had courage. He did the right thing. But with Donald Trump, doing the right thing means it's the wrong thing from his perspective. And you lose your job. Your brother loses his job. And when he told his father it would be all right, sadly, it was not all right for him. And clearly, it's not all right for us. The words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So before I grab my first guest, I have to share a little vignette from my life. So I live in this old 1890 Queen Anne Victorian that I inherited. I don't have a pot to piss in. I should probably be living in a mobile home, but that's okay. I live in a mansion instead. So I have this window that overlooks the street and I call it my Macy's window. And I'm always putting stuff in it, parasols, different things. So yesterday morning, I'm raking my front yard and this mother and her daughter walk past me. And here's what I wrote on Facebook. I have a window in the front of my house that I call my Macy's window. I'm always changing the art, flowers, sculptures, parasols, etc. Yesterday, I was raking my yard and a little girl and her mother walked by when the young lady said, "Are you going to decorate your window for Easter, Arnie?" Oh, I had nearly forgotten that Easter was this Sunday. You know, it's all COVID all the time these days. This morning, I ran down to the basement to see what I could dig up. It's not my best window, but definitely in the Easter mode. And I put rabbits and I put all these little things and parasols in my window. And then I wrote, "Nothing is normal these days, but there are things we can do to remind ourselves who we are, what we love, and that there are little things you can do to hold on to connections." So that's what I posted on Facebook. And if you go to my Facebook page, everyone, you can see my window and my rabbits. So there we go. Now, let me introduce my guest. We have had her on before. She is fabulous. She writes for the American Prospect, one of our favorites. We interview David Dayan a lot. We interview Harold Meyerson a lot. And I think we're going to have to interview Marsha a lot too. And Marsha Brown, correct, Marsha?
Yes.
Wrote a series of pieces, actually, not one, but a series of pieces regarding the prisons and the prison pandemic. Because in a way, it's a little bit discreet compared to what we are experiencing, given the fact that they don't have the versatility to be able to sort of segregate themselves. They can't leave their space. She wrote four articles. One was entitled, "Inside a Federal Prison Where Inmates Can't Stop Coughing." Another one, "Immigration Detention During COVID-19 is a Worsening Nightmare." Another one, "The ACLU Wants Immigrants Out of ICE Detention Now." And then finally, "As COVID-19 spreads, a county jail in Ohio is ill prepared." So let's start with the one about the federal prison where the inmates can't stop coughing. So why don't you share these stories? Because they're both policy stories, but they're really about the reality of the lives inside those prisons And while people weren't willing to be forthcoming with their names, obviously, because they want to protect both their privacy as well as the prisoner that they're dealing with, you got a lot of really amazing information about what it's like in these prisons. So let's start with inside the federal prison. And as you point out, two inmates have died in Elkton Federal Correction Institution.
So the story that I wrote that came out last Friday, I spoke with the wife of an inmate in Elkton, the Federal Correction Institute in near Youngstown in Ohio. And what she told me was that the situation seems to get worse by the hour. And actually, since that piece came out, three inmates have died, and at least two of them have tested positive for coronavirus. I think the third before his test results came back. And since the story came out, I've heard from nearly a dozen family members, all concerned about their relatives and their loved ones. And many of their relatives have nonviolent offenses. They are only in there for 12 months, and they're feeling like this is a death sentence. And that is the words that they're using to talk about this. And so the story went up on Friday. And on Saturday, Attorney General Barr announced that the federal government was looking at ways to decrease the population of federal prisoners in three institutions in Ohio and Elkton, in Oakdale and Louisiana, and in Danbury in Connecticut. And over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal came out with another piece about the situation in Oakdale, which seems to be just as bad. And Danbury seems to be another hotspot. So, but because Ohio doesn't have the tests, we really don't know what the numbers are like. We only have these sort of testimonials from family members and from inmates about what's going on.
So they test people after what they clearly seem to have is the COVID-19. So they're now pre-testing to know who in the institution. You have here that as of Thursday, because this was posted on Friday, you mentioned that three inmates had tested positive, but at least 80 may be exhibiting symptoms of the virus, which corresponds with what you heard from the woman whose husband is in the prison. But the one thing that I thought was so fascinating to me was that as you were telling this story, this is the thing that I posted on Facebook after I read your piece. Ohio's prison system currently operates at about, ready for this everyone, 10,000 people above capacity. Given this, a 10,000 person reduction feels like a potential floor, but not ceiling for overall system numbers in this crisis situation. And when I posted that number, the 10,000, I said, social distance this. So what you already know is that they're packed in like sardines. What you already know is that most of these prisons, you don't have access to the kind of running water you need. You don't have access to the kind of soap you need. So even if you want to maintain any kind of distancing, it is physically not possible. And if you are supposed to be doing the things you're told to do by Dr. Fauci, for example, you know, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands. They can't even do that. Am I right, Marcia?
Absolutely. Social distancing is a fantasy in prison. And what a lot of family members will say is that, you know, they'll tell their husbands, their brothers, their fathers, wash your hands, use hot water. And their, you know, loved ones will respond with what hot water or with what soap? And the facilities really don't seem to be getting the kind of massive cleaning that needs to be done, sterilization, and the idea of, you know, cordoning off people who are exhibiting symptoms versus people who are not, you know, also really doesn't seem to make much of a difference. According to some family members that I spoke to, one husband who exhibited symptoms was moved from his regular block to the block where everybody else was sick. And he said there was no difference. People in both places were coughing. The only difference is that one had a fever, you know, one side was showing a fever and one side didn't. And he said, you know, I'm starting to feel better now. Maybe it was just a cold, but if I didn't have coronavirus before, I'm certainly going to get it now because I'm around everybody else who has it.
Oh my God.
I mean, the idea that it won't spread in these facilities or that it's not in these facilities is just not true. It's everywhere. And it's spreading really fast.
So as you heard that what Barr said, that he wants to reduce the numbers, did he suggest what the approach was going to be, how quickly they were going to move? Because you're hearing three people dead, then four people dead, then five people dead. And let's be honest, I think one of the biggest concerns that Barr has, and we've been discussing this quite a bit on this radio show, we've been really worried about what happened with the detention centers and the federal prisons and even the state and local county prisons. And that is one of the issues that we're hearing is, so if it's a guard who ends up with the illness, we already know most of these guards are working time and a half. There aren't even enough guards to actually adequately supervise most of these federal prisons to start. If they start coming down with an illness, that means they're not going to show up, which means that the pressure on those that are there who have to be terrified because they know that people that they're overseeing have the illness. They know that the potential for them to get the illness because another guard just, you know, didn't come in because he has the illness. And at one point, we had a guy from Texas, and he was talking about the detention centers, but I suspect it's true of probably even at the federal prisons or any of the other prisons. At some point in time, the guards are not going to show up because they don't want to put their lives at risk. I mean, the prisoners can't go anywhere. They can't call in sick. They can't leave their space. But if you're a guard, you didn't sign up for a death warrant. You know, and they don't pay you enough to do this. And clearly they're not protecting you enough. So it's going to be very interesting that what Barr has is a double calamity. You know, he has the people dying within the prison system, but he also has guards. They're going to have to start thinking about whether they want to show. There was a nurse the other day on, I think it was CNN or MSNBC, and she had finally decided that she wasn't going back to work, that she was too terrified, that there weren't enough masks, that she was afraid, and she was crying hysterically because she said, this is my job, it's to take care of people, but I can't die because what do I tell my kids? And I can't bring it home. Well, these are nurses who sign up to do no harm and to take care of sick people. What's a guard doing? So as you were telling these stories and doing these stories, did you get any kind of relationship with the guards and how they're feeling going into these places where clearly they're both unsanitary and it's so easy for them to also be able to come down with this illness?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point, Arnie. So Elkton, the federal prison that I've mostly been reporting on, is already operating at 50% staff because of a lot of what you're talking about. So guards are not coming in. They're using their sick days. Some of them actually are sick. But they're terrified. That's absolutely true. One inmate I heard from said that his case manager had just taken 30 days off. And so now he's trying to file his case so that he can get released early. And he doesn't have a case manager. There's nobody to talk to. There's nobody who's answering their questions. Other inmates are saying that they barely see the staff, that the staff doesn't talk to them, doesn't answer their questions. I have not spoken to staff personally, but I know that other reporters have, and that is the sense, I think, you know, across the board, is that they're all afraid of getting sick. Although admittedly, they're probably the ones who brought the virus into the facility, because in a lot of cases, the prisoners are not leaving or being transferred. This is different in ICE detention, of course, where ICE seems to be operating as normal, but in a lot of prisons, they're not always bringing in new people. So a lot of times it's a staff member who will be the first person who gets sick. Right, and then they have a lot of contact with prisoners or inmates or detainees.
Except I read an article in anticipation of this, I think it was at the Marshall Project. And what one of the professors did say, but you have to understand, there are thousands of people that are being transferred in and being transferred out all the time. I used this story before, I'm going to use it again. I have a guy that's in prison right now. He, you know, had five DWIs. He's coming out supposedly, officially, April 28th. Well, this isn't because he's being early released. He's April 28th. And of course, he has nowhere to go. You know, and he wanted to know, can I live with you? And I'm thinking, I don't think so. But more importantly, it's, I don't know the environment that he's in and how much COVID-19 has spread within the prison he's in. He's coming out not because he's ill, but he may be ill because he may not know it. And then he's coming out. And what's so terrifying is not even the early release people, but the people that are normal, you know, this is your time, you can be released. They normally don't have a place to go. So we've got a situation now, what's happening within the prison is really lethal, not just for the people inside the prison, but for the people that are leaving the prison. Because even if they're early release or they're going on their normal release, they also may be carrying COVID-19 and not know it.
Absolutely. And in addition to that, you also have staff members who go home to their families every single evening. And so they're, you know, possibly spreading the virus throughout their communities. But to your point about inmates who are released or ICE detainees who are released, I think it's important to talk a little bit about a story that I did with an ACLU lawyer who is working on a lawsuit about ICE detainees. Her name is Eunice Cho, and she basically said that the perfect should not be the enemy of the good, because it's really important to get people out of these congregate environments sooner rather than later, because it spreads faster in congregate environments. And the later we wait, the more likely they are to already have the virus, to spread the virus in the community. And it's also important to note that many of these people do have families, and they do have places where they can go, and they can be there for 14 days, and they can quarantine. And if they don't, one of the options that she suggested was something like what we've done with these cruise ships that have docked. There's volunteers that you can have to help people quarantine that way. But I think it is really just important to think about, you know, if we can decrease the populations enough so that people can, you know, have more distance from each other, so that they can isolate if they start to feel sick, that's really important to stopping the spread in these kinds of facilities.
Well, I think it's California, maybe, but I think there are two states that are looking at this population, and what they're doing is they're actually renting hotels and motels, and they're using the hotels and motels for both the prisoners who are coming out, who may not have a place to go, as well as the homeless, and they're putting them in individual motel rooms. So they're giving them a place to be, they're giving them a place to quarantine, so that when they leave the hotel after 14 days, they'll either have had the illness or they don't have the illness. And at least what you're knowing is that the person that you're releasing back into the public arena probably isn't COVID-19 positive. And I think that that's important. What about testing? So every time I read any of these articles, you talk about, well, these two people have tested, but 80 people look like they may have this disease. Doesn't it make sense to almost focus like completely on the prison population and test, so you can at least do some kind of segregation of the population? Because if you're not testing, especially there, they have no place to go. You know, in some ways, because it's this very rigid situation, the idea of testing is important, because you really could do some kind of segregation so you're not spreading it like wildfire. But if you don't do testing, then it's a buckshot, and the likelihood is you'll have 90% of the population in there getting COVID-19, and that would just be even more traumatic.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, at least in the case of Ohio, and I'm sure in the cases of lots of states, there isn't enough tests. There just aren't enough tests.
Right,
and
right.
So when we saw the exponential rise of cases in Rikers Island, I mean, for the most part, my understanding is that they were able to test. In Ohio, they've limited tests basically, I think, to people, this is what I think they're still doing, is to people who are in hospitals or who are medical personnel. So people who are already sick. And so there isn't this kind of preventive testing that's going on. In an ideal world, absolutely, you would want to test everybody so that you can sort of segregate them off from the general population and keep them from infecting any more people. But that just doesn't seem to be an option right now.
Can I ask a question, Arnie?
Yeah.
Marcia, you've been talking a lot about the people that are in prisons and jails, and those folks are clearly in congregate detention, and it's a similar kind of physical environment. But I know you've also visited and written about immigration detention centers, and those are different groups of people. They're obviously all in one place and subject to coronavirus, but they're also people who have not been accused of any crimes. They're in detention because of a civil commitment. And in fact, many, many of them have sought asylum in the United States, and they're being detained pending their asylum hearings. And asylum is a legal right. They are perfectly legal being here. So I wonder if you'd talk about some of the nuances there. And also, as you know, I'm very interested in people who are not even lucky enough, I say, lucky enough, to get into the U.S. immigrant detention centers because they were sent back.
Returned to Mexico.
The return to Mexico policy. They're living in tents. They're just sent away living on the streets across the border in Mexico cities that are within sight of the United States, but not in it. So nobody has jurisdiction. The U.S. prison system has jurisdiction over their detention centers. and localities have jurisdiction over their state and county jails. But the U.S. and the Mexican government just sort of say, hands off, we are not at all responsible for these people. We're not going to prevent them from getting raped and killed. We're not going to feed them. We're not going to make sure their water's clean.
Right,
and,
but they're still
living on top of each other. So if you could just address that.
You actually did two stories in a lot of ways. The little county jail has a lot of detention folks in it from ICE, as well as mm-hmm. in the ICE detention center. So, mm-hmm. you know, why don't you start with the detention center itself? Because you actually tell a story of a Cameroonian woman, which was just fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I mentioned earlier when I said that ICE was operating sort of as if everything is normal, what I meant by that is, one, they're still deporting people. And two, they're still flying people around to different parts of the country and different detention centers, just as they do normally, which, mm-hmm. as any sane person knows, spreads the virus further. And just like I said, with jails and prisons, you have the same kind of congregate environment in an ICE detention center. But the thing to know about ICE detainees, not only are many of them asylum seekers, as Ken points out, but they also are civil detainees, which means that it's really up to ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, DHS. They basically have discretionary power of whether or not those people are behind bars. Right. And so the only thing that, so if they aren't, they don't take that action to sort of preemptively release people, then a judge, an immigration judge or a federal judge can say, no, you need to release these people for X or Y reason. So there've been a lot of lawsuits around the country on this issue. The ACLU has sued, the Southern SPLC has sued, Human Rights First has sued. And in the case of the ACLU lawsuit, they're actually saying that not only are many of these people not criminals, but sort of leaving them in this kind of environment. And many of them are these at-risk populations who have respiratory issues, they have other pre-existing conditions. And should they get sick, you know, she said that they would actually have a 1 in 7 chance of dying. So it's a much higher chance if you're an at-risk population. And that constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. So their legal strategy is actually to say that this is violating people's constitutional rights, even though they may not be a citizen, but they're still within the United States. So I think that's one of the things to think about with these ICE detention centers. And when it comes to jails, so another way that ICE operates is they contract with county jails and other local facilities for beds. I actually read somewhere recently that only 5 facilities are actually operated by ICE itself. The rest are private or county jails. And so you have ICE detainees who are mingling with people who have some kind of, who have a record or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, they're going in and out and the conditions are often very not clean. And so they're very at risk. There isn't the kind of medical attention that they might need, or, you know, maybe language attention and language translation that they might need. So it's a similar situation and it's bad. And then to your point about people along the border, so we've seen in the last year with the quote unquote migrant protection protocols or remain in Mexico policy that I think somewhere around 60,000 people have been forced to stay south of the border in Mexico in places like Matamoros, and they're in essentially unofficial refugee camps living in tent cities. And because they're not sort of a UN declared refugee camp, they don't get institutional assistance. They don't have the medical care that they need or food or, you know, clothing. And, you know, many of these people are asylum seekers with nothing but the clothes on their back, and they've traveled through a dozen Central American countries. And anyway, so they're in these camps and they probably don't have running water or necessarily access to adequate food, and they're expected to wash their hands, which seems like an impossibility.
And social distance.
And have medical care. So I think, you know, that's another population that really is being left out of the equation here and doesn't really seem to have access to any resources.
So Marcia, as I was getting ready for your interview at the American Prospect, go look, there's a whole series, all 4, very well written, very important for us to know. Again, another place I always go when I'm looking for these issues is the Marshall Project, because they do a lot. And I mentioned this before, and I want to end with this because this is really important too. They had a piece just the other day, and it was entitled, Why Jails Are So Important in the Fight Against Coronavirus. And they give an amazing map, everyone. And what they write is, with about 200,000 people flowing into and out of jails every week, there are great risks, not only for the detained, but also for jail workers and surrounding communities. So again, we think that this isn't our problem. They've been, you know, they're segregated, whatever. That number, 200,000, and that of course is Buckshot. If you look at the map, you'll see at this map where you see the greatest number going in and out. You know, no surprise, you know, there are certain places in Texas, for example, that are hotbeds of activity with people going in and out. And so it's not only about the early release that Barr is talking about, it's the people that are actually going in and out anyway. So these are numbers. We can't ignore this. We can't ignore this. We keep hearing about flattening the curve. Well, you're not going to flatten it if you ignore this problem. It'll just constantly add to a spike. Marcia, keep writing for The American Prospect. Keep sending me your stuff. It's fabulous. Again, go to The American Prospect. Marcia Brown has written a whole series about detention and about the federal prisons. You have to care. We're all connected, and this pandemic has actually proven it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Marcia.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1803. That was the day utopian socialist and women's rights activist Flora Tristan was born. She's also remembered as the grandmother of painter Paul Gauguin. Mario Vargas Llosa most recently popularized her life in the 2003 novel The Way to Paradise. Her family was aristocratic, but she grew up in poverty outside of Paris. The young Flora found work in an engraving shop and married the shop artisan, André Chazel. Together, they had three children. When the marriage became violent, she left him, though divorce was impossible. By some accounts, she became a maid for the wealthy and traveled Europe. It was through her travels that she became a socialist. She witnessed abject poverty and inequality in too many countries and was drawn to the work of the utopian socialists. Tristan campaigned for the right of divorce and wrote at length of workers' struggles on the cusp of industrialization. Her novels, which confronted women's inequality and workers' rights, appeared in the late 1830s. She regularly visited feminist and socialist salons in Paris, where ideas linking social transformation and women's rights were popular. Her most well-known work of nonfiction is The Workers' Union, which appeared in 1843. In it, Tristan argues that craft guilds could no longer adequately represent workers in an era of industrialization. She envisioned an international union of workers that organized regardless of skill level, a union that took on broader issues of social justice. Tristan also tied the advancement of women to the advancement of workers. She believed that discrimination against women only strengthened anti-worker forces. Workers and women had to take up each other's causes in order to win true justice. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome to part two of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is the Wednesday edition, April 8th. And believe it or not, we're actually taping this on Wednesday morning, unlike most of our shows, which are taped the day before. And part of the reason is that what happened in Wisconsin on Tuesday was incredible. And we had interviewed Mark Joseph Stern from Slate.com, who gave us the warm-up act on Monday that we actually aired on Tuesday, sort of warning us about what might happen. And this was before the Wisconsin Supreme Court had come down. It was before the United States Supreme Court had come down. What we did know at the time of that interview was that the Wisconsin legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, gaveled in a meeting, said, election's still going on, and then gaveled out. I mean, they literally, if they stayed 15 minutes, it was amazing. So we realized that on Wednesday morning, we needed to reflect about what happened yesterday. And this is going to be an all prospect hour where we were talking about prisons with our first guest from the Prospect. And now we're joined by Harold Meyerson, who's the editor at large at the American Prospect. A fabulous writer. You're pithy, you're smart. But the first piece you wrote was GOP justices decree capital punishment for voting. And I actually referred to it as murder by another name. Mm-hmm. Just unbelievable. So let's sort of reflect for my audience. Everyone's now been hearing what happened, but let's sort of look at what happened yesterday and really what does it mean as we look at 2020? Because as you point out, the Democrats see voter suppression as a problem and Republicans see voter suppression as a solution. And then what I wrote was on Tuesday, it was like a final solution. Welcome to the program. It's a brilliant article. So let's talk about what happened and what does it mean when both the United States Supreme Court as well as the Wisconsin Supreme Court basically played a partisan card that people's health and safety at risk and really sort of undermined the integrity of voting.
The United States Supreme Court, or the Republican majority, I should say, on the United States Supreme Court, now has a pretty extensive history of playing a role in elections that benefits Republicans. Obviously, Bush v. Gore is a big part of that. But then their ruling in the Shelby County case, where they overturned Congress's all but unanimous extension of the Voting Rights Act, to remove federal supervision from states that had practiced whatever form of voter suppression they were practicing. That was part of that. In a sense, the union-related case, Janus versus AFSCME, clearly was designed to diminish the role that major unions played in elections, which tend to be about 98% of the time for Democrats. And now yesterday, the Supreme Court, the five Republicans on the Supreme Court, weighed in again. What they said was that while a federal district judge had said, well, look, the absentee ballots are still in the mail, so we're going to give people until a week from today, the 13th of April, he said, to get their absentee ballots into the mail once they get them. The court said, no, we don't think that's appropriate. They either had to get it into the mail yesterday or forget it. Now, there's been documentation that thousands of absentee ballots have yet to be mailed. And you know, the demographics of this are crucial. Older, more settled voters who tend to routinely vote by mail tend to be Republican. Younger voters who just sort of figure, well, I'm going to go to the poll on election days, they tend to be more Democratic. A lot of them hadn't gotten their absentee ballots yet. And then they face the real prospect of having to stand in line for hours at the greatly reduced number of polling places. The problem in Wisconsin, understandably, was that poll workers said, no, I don't want to show up. So in Milwaukee, which is the largest city, the largest city in Wisconsin, and has the most Democrats of any, you know, population concentration in Wisconsin. In Milwaukee, there are normally 180 polling places. Yesterday, there were five.
God.
And there were lines of people lined up for blocks trying to vote, trying to keep 6 feet distance, trying to cover their faces. And that's where I got the idea of voting as a form of capital punishment. If you want to show up, you literally take your life in your hands. And that's what the Republican Wisconsin justices who got a case in the legislature that overturned the Democratic governor, Tony Evers, his ruling that the election should be canceled. The Wisconsin Supreme Court justices, again, just the Republicans, said, no, we're going to hold this. And the U.S. Supreme Court justices said, no, you can't wait for your absentee ballot to arrive. Clearly, both of these intended to advantage the Republicans. And I should add that the one really close race in Wisconsin that was voted on yesterday was that of a Supreme Court justice, a Republican, who had a very serious Democratic challenger. So, you know, this is, you know, really the question is, should these justices, you know, be employed by the Republican National Committee? Well, why bother? Because they work for free.
Yeah, exactly. They work for free. So let me tell you what I was just so shocked by. I'm not surprised about many of the people on the United States Supreme Court. I was kind of hoping that Justice Roberts, who now has become the swing vote, shockingly, on this bench, would understand the health and safety issues here, and that nobody should be asked to put their life on the line to vote when there are reasonable and rational alternatives that still, I mean, this wasn't even the question of delaying. It was just saying you won't count the write-ins or the absentee ballots for another week. I mean, it's not like this was a heavy lift. This wasn't, and I keep hearing Donald Trump in yesterday's presser, whatever that is, talk about the fact that the only reason why they wanted to delay this vote was because he had endorsed that Wisconsin Supreme Court justice that was running for re-election. And this was all about him, and that it wasn't about the fact that there was a pandemic, and that they've known about the pandemic. I mean, this pandemic every single day is changing our behavior. Every single day, we were told not to mask, now we're told to mask. We were told, you know, not groups of not more than 50, then groups of not more than 10, then shelter in place. Every single day, it's getting narrower and narrower, and we're being told to do less and less things, fewer things. So the fact that whenever they made the decision that they should postpone this election, it was rational, given the fact that we're constantly shrinking our behavior. And so to hear Trump, and then to watch the court, I'm beyond shocked. I can give Trump a pass because he's a lunatic and the madman. I am just shocked at Roberts.
Yeah, well, the other thing that's shocking about Roberts is the one thing that makes Roberts occasionally adhere to just basic empiricism and what the law requires is his concern for the legitimacy of the court. I think that's what, as it were, the soft underbelly of John Roberts is. And I can't see how anyone concerned with the legitimacy of the court could have voted the way Roberts and his four Republican colleagues voted yesterday. That was
Thank you. And
one of the underlying factors in Roberts's desire to preserve legitimacy of the court is if things are so unfair, so just not legal and right, that it will give the appearance of a partisan court, then he shies away from it. We talked on this show with a number of different guests who said, well, Roberts wants you to give him a good reason for doing something that is political and outrageous, but if you don't give him any reason or a spurious reason, he won't go along. And in this case, how can you possibly go along with saying you had to file your votes, your absentee ballots, by 7 o'clock yesterday, when you didn't even get the ballot in the mail before 5 o'clock yesterday? You still haven't gotten the ballot in the mail, and yet you were supposed to file it yesterday. That just, I can't see how Roberts can justify that in his own mind about the legitimacy of the court.
Now, well, the other side of this is as a much younger lawyer, almost 20 years ago, I should say, Roberts was one of the Republican attorneys who went down to Florida worked for the Republicans in the Bush v. Gore election controversy of the 2000 election. And he's a dutiful Republican, and he sure was dutiful on Monday night when he...
Listen, dutiful, this is murder. I'm sorry, you wrote capital punishment, I wrote murder. Yes. And what I said the other day, and I told you this, Harold, when I called you, was that I put down that the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because this is definitely a potential contamination situation. There is no question about it. Right. And when you realize, especially in Milwaukee, as you point out, which has the highest concentration of Democrats in the state, which shrunk from 180 polling places to 5. What you really see is this was lethal. It was intentionally lethal. Yeah. They want people to die because if people die, then Donald Trump can win because Wisconsin is one of the states that are basically in play for the 2020 election. Yeah. I mean, you might as well have a target on the black on the back of every Democratic voter, especially
people of color.
And especially people of color.
Most of the people of color in the state of Wisconsin live in Milwaukee.
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a story that just came out. And again, I want to go back to the ridiculous presser that Donald Trump had where he was shocked that so many people of color are dying, shocked that this was happening. Well, actually in Milwaukee County, that's exactly what they found out. They looked at the percentage of minorities that live in Milwaukee County, the number of people that have actually contracted COVID, and the number have died. And when you look at the number of people that have contracted it, like over half, I believe, are people of color. The number of people that have died, I think, is in the 80% range. So in a lot of ways, this was literally targeting them. And the numbers the court knew before they made their decision, they could see who was contracting COVID and who was dying in Milwaukee County, and they still made that decision, Harold.
And, you know, in essence, voter suppression is really a central Republican strategy because, you know, look, if you look at the polls, there are more people disapproving of Trump than approving. If you look at the past elections, both Bush v. Gore and 2016, the Democrat got more popular votes than the Republican presidential nominee, but the Electoral College gave it to the Republican. Sometimes you can't even count on the Electoral College. Voter suppression is how a party that is drifting into minority status maintains its power. And that's what all of this ultimately is about. It's about the flouting of majority rule. Our Constitution does not really enshrine majority rule through the Electoral College, through the Senate. And, you know, when that's not enough, you get the kind of crap, you should pardon the expression, that we saw in the court rulings on late Monday.
And the other side of the coin, by the way, in addition to suppressing the Democratic voters, the court has also given a special hand to the Republican candidates in Citizens United. So in your litany of Republican-oriented Supreme Court decisions, I think Citizens United needs to be right up there because it so favors Republicans.
Well, what was interesting about Mark Stern's interview on Monday was that he pointed out that the Koch brothers spent a lot of money in Wisconsin. And the Koch brothers spent a lot of money in Wisconsin, not just on what was going on in governor's races and legislative races. They spent a lot of money going about what was going on with the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. So what you are seeing is, again, that connection from Citizens United to what the Koch brothers were able to do in Wisconsin. This was kind of like their petri dish. And yes, it's just kind of, it's kind of shocking when you see this. But I just have to ask a question. I understand voter suppression. And I understand that the Republicans, you know, don't support, you know, expansion of Medicaid. They don't support the Affordable Care Act. They don't support raising the minimum wage. That's kind of like slow death. Okay?
Right.
But what this was about in the time of a pandemic, this is about quick death.
Yep.
Now, usually they're subtler. You know what I mean? I mean, right. they want you to die over the course of generations, but they don't want you to die tomorrow.
Right.
And so because this is about a pandemic, I am just so shocked that they're willing to show their hand because they might as well have, you know, they might as well have had a weapon in their hand because right. That's exactly what they were doing was they were literally kind of shooting people, only they didn't need a bullet. They needed a ballot.
Good point. But they've also, this has been a very active week for them and on the slow death front too, because they've finalized the regulation that strips from California and the 12 other states that have gone along with California, its own clean air standards, which are stricter than the US ones. And they ratcheted back the deal that had been cut during the Obama administration about miles per gallon and auto emissions and things like that. So, you know, I mean, they're killing us slowly as well as killing us quickly.
I think we need to make a movie.
They can walk and chew gum at the same time as far as knocking off the American public goes.
Again, I think that's your next piece. Killing us softly or slowly and killing us quickly.
Actually,
and now
I've written that already.
All right. See, I love you. We think alike. We must have a similar DNA. But I wanna go to your other article before we let you go, because we only have a few minutes left. And that is that you wrote a piece about the sort of the bread line. That was what you were writing. And I actually, you had a hyperlink in your piece at the American Prospect. And I went to that hyperlink, which was talking about the free meals for all New Yorkers starting Friday that Mayor de Blasio had decided. And when I posted it on Facebook, thank you so much for hyperlinking it, I wrote, "The breadline New York City style. With so many folks without earnings who didn't qualify for food stamps before the pandemic and have no savings because their income barely covers expenses, de Blasio responds, guess what? They still need to eat." So share with us the story that you shared, not only about what de Blasio has done, but what you see happening with all the sort of, you know, food banks around the country, because I think people would be absolutely shocked. They're all being sort of sheltering in place and watching Trump pressers. What they're not doing is seeing the bread lines.
That's right. And, you know, we have this classic image of bread lines from the 1930s, right? People, you know, standing in very long lines, sort of like voting in Milwaukee, on the sidewalks. Now, the bread lines we're seeing now tend to be people in their cars. So it's sort of a neo bread line. But the lines of cars in Pittsburgh, that's been longer than a mile, also in Dayton, Ohio, and other cities too, people, you know, lined up, and the food banks are getting patronage, if that's the word for a food bank, that sometimes is four or five times higher than what is usually the case. And I noted that yesterday, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said we really have to expand the eligibility and the amount we give for food stamps for the SNAP program, because among other things, if more Americans are able to get food stamps, and believe me, more Americans need them right now, then they can actually, you know, shop and reduce this endless bread line that's now forming at America's food banks.
Well, and what we also heard, Harold, and you know this, is that, you know, everyone's waiting for their $1,200 check, right, or their unemployment check or whatever. So we see all the unemployment offices around the country crashing because they've never had to deal with this many numbers. So even if you're qualified for unemployment, you may not be getting unemployment. And right, then we found out that the $1,200 check may not even find the person who needs it until August.
Right.
Until August, which means they're going to starve between now and August, which is why what Mayor de Blasio did was so interesting. And I don't know whether other states could do this, but why don't you explain to people what he's doing? Because he's using a already built-in system, but right, it's a system designed for children, but he's expanding it to adults. So let right, my this audience is, know. This is brilliant.
The free lunch program.
For yeah. Trade, did you freeze?
Which the federal government funds. It serves them lunch and breakfast. So the first right, thing they did was at dinner. The second thing they did was if someone in the kid's household was unable to come down and pick it up, they said, we do delivery. Then the third thing they did, and this is really for America, unfortunately, it breaks precedent in a good way. It's unfortunate that the precedent exists. They just said, look, anyone who's hungry can come down and get these meals. In other words, it's a universal program, and ostensibly we have some universal programs, like everyone over 65 is on Social Security, mm-hmm, but there are always exceptions, whatever. No, this is a real, almost European style,
yes,
universal program. You do not have to produce an ID. If you're hungry, come down, you'll get a meal. You know, by European standards, this is relatively common. By American standards, unfortunately, this is unheard of. New York usually has a more generous social welfare state condition than the rest of America. But this really, I think, is adequate to the situation we have now. And as you just pointed out, with, you wow, know, getting your $1,200 in August, a lot of what we have now is far from adequate. So New York really, really shines as far as.
And could I add something yeah, to that universality? The federal stimulus bill is that immigrants, undocumented immigrants, are not eligible for any of the relief.
This they would be, but right, this but they would this, be.
So I hope that at least in New York City, where it's universal, these 11 million people who are working hard and paying taxes into the system, making my Social Security possible, you know, they can actually get access to some of the $1 trillion of benefits.
Yeah, yeah. So this is New York exceptionalism in a very positive way. Yes.
But let me just quote from the article from NBC News, just because I want people to hear this. All adults, children, and families are able to get 3 free meals each day at more than 400 locations across the city, most of which are city schools, which will be closed until at least April 20th, if not longer. So what Bill de Blasio has done is universality, which is incredible. You don't have to produce any documentation. So you can be an undocumented immigrant. You can be an unemployed person. Frankly, you could be a billionaire and walk in if you want a free meal. So it's kind of, it's neutral and blind to this. The reason why this story is so important, Harold, is that my show airs in Houston, Texas. Houston, Texas is a huge metropolitan area. It has over 600,000 undocumented immigrants in Houston alone. So that means those people, for the most part, have either lost their job or are in very precarious economic situations. Houston should consider picking up a page from Mayor de Blasio and New York, because they are also going to see the situation. And I would just hope that cities around the country begin to realize that because it's going to take so long to get these funds into people's hands, at least for the bridge, this is essential.
Yes. And, you know, we should also be aware that even if Houston did this, the Republican state government might choose to preempt it, because Texas is one of those states where all the big cities are politically Democratic and governed by Democrats, but the state legislature and the state elected officials are Republican. And what we've seen repeatedly on any number of issues is when that happens and a city chooses to enact a more generous benefit, be it a higher minimum wage or whatever, the Republican state government usually passes a law saying you can't do that. So unfortunately, the challenge for a city like Houston can't entirely be decided by Houston. It's often decided by the state government, which is well to the right of the city government.
And preemption is actually a problem between the federal government and states as well, same as states vis-a-vis the cities. If it fits within your political goals as a Republican administration, you say that it preempts the states. If state Governor Abbott in Texas says my conservative views say that Houston can't do these progressive things, then he shuts it down and says you're preempted by the state. Preemption is a real interesting issue to look at.
But I also want to point out that the last paragraph in your article talks about Jose Andres, who is one of the most socially responsible top chefs. And as he points out, look, what I did in Puerto Rico, this needs to happen nationally. This is a way for us to sort of employ some of those restaurant workers now that aren't working. They could be doing this. They know how to put food out. This is a good use of their time. And what I'm concerned about is we really need to do testing. We need to actually take everyone's temperature. We need to make sure that even as we're putting this food out, even as people are coming together to get this food, that we keep them as safe as possible. Because again, that's part of the problem. So many people have a need that you want to still make sure that you protect them. At the same time, you understand that part of protecting them is feeding them.
Right. And what Jose Andres has done here in Washington, D.C., where I am and where he has a number of terrific restaurants, he has sort of established free food kitchens on the sidewalks outside his restaurants, his own version of New York, you know, no ID required. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
He's the closest thing we have to a local Bill de Blasio.
Yeah.
And, you know, what he's calling for is the federal government embracing this in part by directing money towards restaurants so their cooks can do this and be employed. But there aren't enough Jose Andreses and there aren't enough New York cities at the moment, unfortunately. And as a consequence, people will go hungry.
Well, I need to let you go, but I think that it's really interesting how, you know, people who never believed in sending everyone a check, i.e. Republicans, are suddenly sending everyone a check. Everyone who used to think that you shouldn't bail out certain people and add $600 to an unemployment check are now adding $600 a week to an unemployment check. So you are seeing a rapid change in part because starving people won't vote for you. Okay. Yes. And dead people won't vote for you. And the Republicans are thinking that the only starving people and dead people will be Democrats. I hate to break it to you. In Kentucky, in Missouri, in Tennessee, in Mississippi, they will be your voters and they will be starving and they will be dead. So it'll be interesting to see how you see an evolution on whether we do the kinds of things that we see Bill de Blasio doing.
Let us hope, because if not, this country is going to be even in worse shape than any of us could imagine.
Harold Meyerson, God, please join me anytime and have a happy Zoom Passover. And thank you so much for writing what you write. We'll talk to you soon. All right, ciao. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. See you tomorrow.
Aksamea.
Oh, yeah, that too. Okay.
Yeah, that too. Thank you so much. That was great. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.